I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writers House in our third floor Garrett studio by Tom Devaney, poet, teacher, essayist, Jeffersonian, and Edgar Allan Poean, truly great reviewer. Can I say Poean or is it Poesque or whatever it is? That's what you are, and a longtime producer of a monthly literary radio program on XPN 88.5 locally, whose most recent book of poems is A Series of Small Boxes. And did I mention that Tom is a great teacher? And by Lynn Din, Saigon-born Philadelphian, whose most recent book of poems is Some Kind of Cheese Orgy. Great title, Lynn. Being published by Chax Press, and whose much-updated blog called Detainees is full of, among other things, photographs perfectly capturing our economic moment. I recommend it. And by Ray Armantrout, whose most recent book of poetry, Versed, was published in January 2009 and is, am I right, Ray, a National Book Award finalist?
Yeah, amazing.
Oh, that's exciting. Whose Next Life, 2007, Wesleyan, was chosen as one of the 100 notable books of 2007 by the New York Times, and whose other books include Collected Prose, 2007, Up to Speed, 2004, The Pretext, 2001, and Veil, New and Selected Poems, also 2001, also Wesleyan. Ray is visiting us from San Diego / La Jolla, somewhere in there, where she teaches at UCSD. Hello, all three of you. Welcome back to Poem Talk, Lynn and Tom. Good
Hi,
to see Al. You guys.
Good morning. Good to see you.
And welcome back to the Writer's House, Ray. You've been here a number of times, but we are delighted that you're here and to Poem Talk for the first time.
It's always good to be here.
Thank you. Today, our poem is Kit Robinson's Return on Word, published in his 2002 book, The Crave. Penn Sound's Kit Robinson page has two recordings of this poem, made on successive nights in November 1999 at a reading in Buffalo one night and here in Philadelphia at the Writer's House the next. Probably snow in Buffalo that day and sunny and 60 in Philly the next day. We're going to hear the latter recording, the one made in Philadelphia, along with a brief remark the poet makes in response to the audience, which loved the poem. So here now is Kit Robinson performing Return on Word.
This is called Return on Word. If we look in the direction, these words will have to do, adding to the enormous burden of words. The entire concept is entirely too conceptual. All we need is a few good words anybody can relate to declare an identity no one can take away. But which ones? A handful of interest, several people in a room, for several hours, couldn't come up with. The point is to decide, then move as one, up and down, in an altered state. This is easier said than done. We are getting close, very close. We are getting better. We are going to have a great year. There is going to be hell to pay. It's gonna be a fucking bloodbath. Then the return to words. Thought has taken a contract out on, and the ability to quietly move on. You would appreciate that, Ron. Those of us who work for marketing organizations understand that poem very well.
Okay, well, there's a lot to talk about. First, I suppose we should identify Ron. Those of us who've listened to Ron Silliman in an audience laugh and appreciate a poem could hear it. And then the poet refers to Ron Silliman, who's probably sitting in the first row, and then refers to marketing. We can talk about, you know, what sense that makes. But let's get back. When I see, Ray, a few good words, and knowing how Kit Robinson loves to torque idioms and familiar phrases, as you do too, all I heard was the Army needs a few good men. Do you want to start with that and riff on it a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I heard too. I mean, I see this poem, I guess, as pat phrases gone bad, kind of, you know. I mean...
Some others?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the point is to decide sounds sort of, you know, we are getting close to something. We are getting better. All of these. And then we're going to have a great year. There's going to be hell to pay, of course, is a...
So he's actually escalating the common flat idioms, the dead metaphors.
Right, yeah. Until it's a fucking bloodbath.
And then there's a pause, Lynn, and the poem turns back to a quieter mode. It sort of catches itself. And then that wonderful pun, return to words from return onward. What would you say, Lynn, about that transition toward the end? I mean, does he really mean to get back to his point, or is he doing something else there? Any thoughts on that?
Actually, this poem is probably more coherent than most other Kit Robinson poems I've read. I mean, I think he likes to do these abrupt shifts, you know, in tone, in texture, and, you know, going from a kind of jivey vocabulary to a kind of a scholarly tone. So in a sense, this is less, there are fewer violent shifts in this poem than most other Kit Robinson poems, you know, so...
Why do you think he generally likes to do that? What's the effect?
I think it's exciting to do.
Oh, he gets excited and then...
Well, I think it's exciting for the reader.
Oh, so he's creating a sense of excitement. Tom, what do you want to do with that last pause? He gets out of control. It's going to be a fucking bloodbath. Audience responds. Then the return to words. What's he saying?
Well, that stands before... We're going to have a great year. We're going to have hell to pay. It's going to be a fucking bloodbath. It's interesting. Those phrases are almost equivalent, though they escalate into the last line. But then it's just like almost what poetry can do, the surprise of, and then the return to words, as if we weren't already in words before this. So what does words mean if we weren't using words? But it's a great little shift there, as if we had left words.
Can someone start us off, maybe Ray, on the whole issue or thematic about economy and return on investment and so forth? I mean, is this a poem about economics?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, I think, a poem about, I see it as both a kind of corporate boardroom pep talk, but also more than economics, or this is related to economics, sort of about branding, because they're trying to come up with a phrase, I guess, that they can all identify with, a kind of label that they can all identify with.
An answer, a solution, a thing.
Well, to declare an identity.
That's it.
He says to declare an identity. And I think that kind of works both ways, because obviously that could be sort of branding in a corporate sense, you know, what's our corporate identity, but also, you know, poets sort of brand themselves in a way sometimes, or get branded. Poets are labeled too. So I think
he's satirizing the business way of talking, but he's also aiming it at us too, right?
I think so, because it starts out in the beginning, we don't know that it's going to turn into kind of corporate boardroom talk, and it seems to be about words, and it may even seem to be about writing. You know, these words will have to do. Well, before we have a context for that, we think these words on the page will have to do, adding to the enormous burden of words. And so isn't that the way we might feel when we start to write? Like, why would I add anything to what's already been written?
If we look in the direction, these words will have to do, adding to the enormous burden of words. The entire concept is entirely too conceptual. All we need is a few good words anybody can relate to declare an identity no one can take away. But which ones? A handful of interest, several people in a room, for several hours, couldn't come up with.
The vocabulary is kind of flat. I know he's satirizing a certain kind of talking. And I find myself almost wishing for him to push these conflicts a little further.
Or maybe to break out into... I'm going to put air quotes here, his own voice. Of course, that wouldn't be something he would do.
But
and
in other poems, he does.
Ray wouldn't like him as a poet if he did that, broke into his own voice, would you? Wow.
Well, I do think that, you know, as Lynn is saying, there's a different voice in different poems. And this one is, as some other poems in The Crave are, very much about this kind of, well, as a lot of his recent work is, the kind of conjunction where writing and being a writer meets being a business person.
Mm.
But I think one thing we haven't spoken about yet in that last phrase is the word taken, the words taken a contract out on. Because, yeah, to return to words might be positive, but there's a kind of sinister implication to take a contract out on.
Hilarious.
That almost harks back to, I mean, it's, you know, like that's what the mafia does, right? A contract hit. So it almost harks back to the violence of, you know, a few good words, a few good men.
So the mafia is to the person they want to rub out as thought is to the words of the poem? And how does that work, if so?
Well, it's provocative. I'm not sure exactly how it works. Then the return to words thought has taken a contract out on in order to move them around. So that's the ultimate purpose, I guess, is to free things up. I mean, all of these pat phrases that might seem to make only one kind of sense, if
make
you can
it
move them around, you can
Taking a contract out on words is to make it new. It's sort of, think of Williams in his phase where he wanted to have his poems flatten the Carpathian Mountains or something, you know, really wipe the place out. Tom, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking so many things. The title of the poem is called Return on Words, and just to skip
return
back.
Return on Word.
Return on Word. So return on word, as if you were getting dividends or something for this word. But I think it's a poem, if it's about anything, it's about values being at odds with each other.
Let me turn this on Ray. To the extent that there's been criticism of your work, and I haven't seen much of it, you know, because it's...
Oh, I've seen some.
I was being a host there. But, you know, one could say, well, gee, Ray's got everybody else's voice, and boy, is she good at that. And she's hearing the language, and she's got her ear to the ground of the way we talk. But where's Ray? I want Ray. I want identity. I want something. And I think maybe you could say this about this. So since Ray's here and Kit's not, would you either speak for Kit, because you wouldn't speak for yourself, given the discussion?
I wouldn't speak for Kit either.
Would you say something about that?
Yeah, well, there's an older poem of mine that starts, Ventriloquy is the mother tongue. So, I mean, I think that we learn to speak from others, and we learn to speak in their phrases. We learn to mimic our mothers and our fathers, right, before we, I mean, you know, so when does one's own voice come in? I'm not saying that you don't have your own voice, but I'm saying that, you know, that perhaps everyone's voice is a composite that they make unique by the way they compile all of the voices that are out
so
there.
So the person who grows up in Ron Silliman's Albany and the person who grows up in Lynn Hajinian's My Life is a languaged self, and what better a way to present it than in that now, sorry for the word now, classic, disrupted, unchronological, seemingly random mode, which compress and condense very much would be a poem that you would write or a poem that Kit Robinson writes. So that's the answer to this. And when he says, when Kit Robinson's poem says, this is easier said than done, we are getting close, very close, we are getting better, that is a mock of the, let's say, marketing world notion that we can, that's it, we've got it, we've solved it, we know, that's the perfect phrase, Mad Men.
Yeah. Oh, I love that show.
Yeah. I mean,
and also
I think
the language of optimism, right?
The language of optimism. Right, and then it turns into something ugly, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, we've got it. This is the slogan. This is going to work. This is it. This is the moment. You know, we're going to fucking take over with this thing. And then he returns us to a soberer. And I think I like the sense of that transition.
The point is to decide, then move as one, up and down, in an altered state. This is easier said than done. We are getting close, very close. We are getting better. We are going to have a great year. There is going to be hell to pay. It's going to be a fucking bloodbath. Then the return to words. Thought has taken a contract out on, and the ability to quietly move on.
Bob Perlman gave me a copy of The Grand Piano, and Kit was talking about his life in the theater and being involved with it. When I was reading this poem, I thought, this is a poem written on a napkin of a character in a David Mamet play. And it's just, there's something, you know, part of the flatness of the language sometimes is the thoughtlessness of how language is used becomes part of the what language is, and so that's what's going on here.
So I have a question for Lynn, and Lynn, I'm sorry to slot you into a role here at Poem Talk, but sometimes you respond to a poem like this and want to say, look, there are economic issues being talked about here. There is a way of misrepresenting how language works in the business world. There is a lingua franca here. There are real economic issues or ethical issues about how we use our words and so forth. So I guess I'm inviting you, if you want to do a socioeconomic or sociopolitical either critique of this poem for not going far enough to stake its claim, or to commend it for such. I'm inviting you to do such a reading if you want.
the last time I was a little bit negative, so I don't want to do that again. And I mean, I like this poem, and actually, I don't know when it was written. Does anyone know when it was written?
Well, I imagine
it came out in
99,
right?
99. Well, I think the book came out in 2002.
Okay. Before.
He read the poem before 99. Live audiences in 1999.
Okay. So that's when it was new.
So it's a .com bust, but it's a happy 90s, right. low unemployment time.
Before the economy became
became
the central issue. So it's a different climate then. Yeah. Getting back to the language of optimism, and I just noticed there are more slogans. Well, every culture employs slogans to cheer up the populace, but banks have slogans, government have slogans, so it's interesting that
literary movements have slogans.
Exactly.
But it's like as you're running out of money, we have more words to fill us.
I'm gonna do the Lynn thing then, invite you to, I'll do it, I'll do the thing you want, I want you to do, right? When he says all we need is a few good words, that there's a militaristic slogan being borrowed. All we need is a few good men, and we will, Afghanistan will be fine. All we need is a few good men, and the military objectives can be achieved. If we have a few mediocre men, it won't be. A few good men, yes. Okay, now, all we need is a few good words. And the problem of marketing our product or understanding what little thing we have to say is going to be solved. And we're going to have a great year, meaning we're going to make a fuckload of money.
Right.
So he's inviting us to say something about the note. He's basically militarizing happy marketing talk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe Ron's laugh was uncomfortable. I don't know. Any thoughts on any of this?
I just want to say something, which is like the idea of like words for hire doesn't shock me as much as the idea of like thought for hire.
Mm-hmm.
That's the more menacing part that I think he pivots into.
Mm-hmm.
So words for hire, okay, we can understand that people are going to write for money or whatever. Thought for hire, he's pushing in there.
Let me read the last stanza as the way it's printed in the book, and then the way it's performed.
Because there's a difference. The last line.
So here's the way it's printed. Then the return to words thought. Then the return to words thought has taken a contract out on, in order to move them around. It's performed presumably an earlier version that he revised for the book. Then the return to words thought has taken a contract out on. And the ability to quietly move on. That the earlier variant sounds Ashberian in a way.
Yes.
And the final line sounds much more Kit Robinsonian. Anyway, you want to react to that?
I do. The last line sounds, as it in the final version, sounds more positive somehow. It sounds like it'd be good to be able to move things around. Whereas to just quietly walk away from your hit sounds a little more sinister, like, we've succeeded, now we quietly fade and pretend that we haven't. So it seems like he moved away from that a bit and gave it a somewhat ambiguously positive spin in the last line to me.
Interesting. I have to say, I like to read this poem almost as a comment on the poetics that Kit Robinson likes to be part of. So if I can do a kind of institutional reading, in order to move them around, I was referring to Albany and My Life before. I mean, in a way, what you can do to the narrative, to the American narrative of growing up in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, is to move the sentences around, just to trivialize the innovation. And in a way, he's, I think, mocking that or pushing himself to realize that, well, when all is said and done, in order to be different from the bastard marketers who think they've got language just right. All we have to do is move things around. And it's a very superficial reading of language poetry or of discontinuity in poetry. But one, it almost invites that criticism, whereas and the ability to quietly move on suggests a kind of silent suffering. I almost like that line better. Anyway, do you, Ray, do you feel like reacting to my overreading of this sly reference to language poetry?
Yeah, I too saw that as a kind of reference to that sort of poetics. I didn't know whether it was negative or not, but it might be now that you mention it. I mean, I think when he starts talking about language in the first couple of stanzas, he seems to be sort of mocking the what might even be the essential emptiness of words. I mean, the entire concept is entirely too conceptual. You know, the redundancy there is, you know, pointed as if words can't really say very much.
And when he says this is easier said than done, a classic platitude, but then it strikes a stake in the heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we could go on and on about this, but I want to invite each of you to offer one last observation on the poem, or really anything, on where the poem fits in the larger poetics that he's interested in, something we forgot to talk about. Ray, do you have something more you want to say?
Well, only that I read this poem to my students recently, and they loved it. They laughed all the way through it, and they started getting it right away. And
what's the laugh line?
Well, you know, people didn't laugh at the reading at fucking Bloodbath, although I would have. But they laughed earlier, and then they laughed right after that.
They laughed at the transition one, then the return to work.
Which was smart, I guess.
Yeah. A knowing audience.
Yeah.
So you were saying you read this to your students, and they laughed.
They liked it. So, I mean, it's a sort of accessible poem, which is perhaps a little frightening, because we all know that we're sort of in this place. We're sort of caught in this loop of increasing, well, the cliche is commodification of the self, you know, labeling of the self to be a saleable product. And I think, you know, it gets to that, and everyone knows that that's where we are.
So it actually tells us something very important that we already know, but it does it well.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, Lynn?
I find this poem strangely kind of airless, you know. It's like it refuses to yield very much as far as sensual pleasures, you know. I mean, the texture of it. So, I think maybe that's the whole point of it, you know, is this sort of...
I think it might be, yeah.
Yeah, this arid poem, but... I find myself preferring other Kit Robinson poems where there's more.
So this is a meta poem about a poem that doesn't give you any return on words, hoping that there will be another day where a poem will give you a return.
It's a stingy poem for me.
Yeah, stingy poem. Well, no, that's good. I like that.
But the heart of the poem, though, does sort of echo our conversation here for several hours, couldn't come up with the point. Is to decide we can't, then move as one up and down in an altered state, and we haven't moved as one up and down.
That's terrific.
So that's where I want to end.
We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail, commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. And if we're all brief about this, we can get three recommendations in. So, Ray, do you have something you want to recommend?
Other people have discovered this a couple of years ago, but I recently read The Golden Age of Paraphernalia by Kevin Davies. And I thought that it was a pretty amazing take on the economy, I guess, as an environment. That's one thing it's about.
Thank you. Lynn?
By the time this goes on air, this book should be out, Destruction Myths by Matthias Svalina. So the density of the book and just the exuberance of the book, these are decreation myths or something, you know.
Can you spell Svalina, the last name?
Svalina.
Thank you. Tom?
I've been reading poems of poets in the 60s and the 70s. I've just been sort of immersed in that scene, and I just read The Morning of the Poem yesterday by James Schuyler and sort of blew me away.
Can you give us a 15-second summary of the project you're working on now? It's a great project.
I'm writing a book called Poems 1962-1972. And I was born in 1969, so basically...
It's a little problematic.
3 years old, but yeah. It's very based in reacting to photographs as well as that moment, that decade, if that could be an entity.
I don't usually gather paradise, but I'm going to gather a little paradise that's a little hellish. I'm rereading the Maximus poems. And I've rediscovered a poem that Olson did not include in the Maximus poems. It's called Maximus to Gloucester, Letter 27. And I highly recommend it. It's a marvelous, marvelous poem, and it gives me a handle on the rest of that giant, ridiculous project. Well, that's all the return on poetic investment we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writers House at the University of Pennsylvania and Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks so much to my guests, Lynn Dinh, Tom Devaney, and Ray Armantrout, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer today, Steve McLaughlin, and to our editor, the very same Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Bob Perlman, Charles Bernstein, and Robert Grenier join me in a discussion of two of Grenier's favorite very short poems by William Carlos Williams. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again for that or another Poem Talk.